So a few people turned up who are not on retreat. You know, we notice these things. And we noticed that a lot of people turned up who are not on the retreat. But where were you on Saturday? It's like, I really want to get enlightened and have this perfect, supreme enlightenment and be free of all desires. But not on a Saturday night. So we noticed there are more people here on Monday than there were on Saturday. So hopefully now, coming towards the end of the retreat, Graham is getting better. He's well enough to do the talk, but I'm on a roll. Maybe not. And so hopefully you all have a good taste and feeling for the practice, and those of you who have been practicing before or practicing longer have reinvigorated your practice. Is the direction clear? Everything clear? What you have to do? Clear as mud, but we covered the ground. The confusion made my head spin round. Nasruddin. You may wonder why I'm talking about Nasruddin, but I'm in the library, you see, and I have a Nasruddin book next to my bed. So you may think I have a wonderful memory for all these stories, but I just read it 2 minutes ago, that's why. Nasruddin, his donkey escaped and ran off. So Nasruddin went chasing after his donkey. And then a friend of his saw him running and said, "Nasruddin, where are you going to in such a hurry?" And he said, "I don't know, ask my donkey." So sometimes I feel like this with Dharma practice, that I don't know where it's heading. Some time ago, you know, if you'd have asked me like 10 years ago, what are you trying to achieve or what do you think will happen? You know, I was like, well, I'm going to get jhana, I'm going to get psychic powers, then I'm going to quit the monkhood and I'm going to sell my psychic powers to corporations who will pay me lots of money to predict things, and then I'll get, you know, lots of money and they'll pay me lots of money and I'll use that money to get a really nice cabin. And I'll go up to that cabin and I'll set it up like this and like this and I'll get two dogs. And then what? Then I can meditate. Right? It took me a while to realize that I'm already here, you know. I'm already able to meditate. Sometimes it feels like you're acting in the dark a little bit. You know, what you think is going to happen to you when you meditate isn't probably not what does happen. And I see this a lot with lay people who may do a retreat and get rather inspired. And then they think, wow, if I could be a monk, then my whole life would be like that. Imagine, you know, what I attained to in like 5 days on a retreat. Imagine if I had 5 years as a monk, it would be fantastic. Sometimes they actually come and ordain, but of course, it doesn't work like that. It was just a momentary bit of inspiration while you're on a retreat. And often people come and ordain, and then they get very disappointed. They think, you know, they wonder why it's not all like being on retreat. As a lay person, you may have little time to meditate, and then you think to yourself, what if I just, you know, if I had 5 free hours of a day, every day, I would meditate for 3 hours a day. And of course you don't. And many meditation teachers, when they get away on their own, they don't do very much meditation. You know, formal sitting meditation. Of course the meditation's never very far away from you, but it's not like you spend all day sitting in this wonderful bliss and pacing backwards and forwards. Usually you get involved in things, you know, in regular things in daily life also. I actually found this myself, that it's much easier, much better for myself to meditate when I've got stuff that's stopping me from meditating. If I have to go and do a talk at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock, I'm really going to meditate because that's the only hour I'm going to have free. If I've got all day free, when I sit down to meditate, one part of my mind goes, well, if I don't do it now, I can do it later. And then, why don't I just think this thought out first? And I'll plan out that book you've been planning to write, got time. Even though I put in hours, I've always been someone who who's willing to put in hours on the cushion. We call it bum time. It's the technical term. I've always been willing to put in bum time. But quality meditation time, I need deadlines. I need stuff that I have to do. So then I really appreciate the time that I have to meditate. So don't feel that all you really need to do is get away from your husband or your wife or your children or your job or the heat of Thailand or something like that, because you have the opportunity right now. We're always working a little bit in the dark. We're always like Nasruddin chasing his donkey, that we're not quite sure where the Dhamma is taking us. We're not quite sure what qualities we're going to be developing. I had got on this retreat with Stephen up in the mountains in December last year. I was just really enjoying the cold air up there. It's beautiful, crisp, clean, cold air. And I was just enjoying that. But I thought, you know, I'm really going to try Mahasi Sayadaw system, because the way I meditate is a little bit different. It's still all Dhamma, it's the same stuff, but a slightly different approach. But it just turned out the thing that I ended up working on the retreat was patience. And, you know, I wasn't getting these really strong, concentrated mind states, which sometimes I get on my own when I meditate. But patience was the thing that I was learning. Sometimes it's endurance. Sometimes you're having wild and wacky experiences. Sometimes you're having very unwild and unwacky experiences. Pain, suffering, grief. So it's often the case that the practice is not taking you where you thought it was going to take you. You're not developing the quality that you thought you were going to develop. But this is where you get dynamic. You get a little bit inventive. You're willing to adjust and change. We get back to my boxing metaphors. Boxers who go in there with one plan, when they go in against a very good fighter, they just get outfoxed. This is what you're going to see on Saturday night when you tune in to Floyd Mayweather. His opponent is a fabulous boxer, but Floyd Mayweather is just dynamic. Whatever you do, you'll notice that he'll lose the first few rounds and he'll be like kind of cagey and he'll back off and you'll think, yeah, he's no good, he's getting beaten. But he's just working his opponent out. And within a few rounds, you know, he'll be winning like every moment of every round. And this is what he always does. So we're a little bit like that with the Dhamma practice, that you learn to get a little bit dynamic, a little bit inventive. At the end of the day, there's no teacher can tell you what's going on inside your mind. They can only give advice. He can only give tools. Buddha reputedly could do this. He could look in someone's mind and see exactly what they needed. But even his top monks and top arahants couldn't do that. Famously, one monk was told to meditate on dead bodies. I just realized how weird that sounds. But in the scriptures, you meditate on dead or decaying bodies as a way to break lust or to break self-identity. And he got nowhere with this meditation practice until he went to meet the Buddha, and the Buddha saw that he was a goldsmith in many lifetimes. So he said, instead of meditating on a dead body, meditate on a golden body. And the person was able then to attain to Dhamma. But, you know, in the absence of someone like the Buddha, and bear in mind that even many people went to meet him and he was unable to help them. Many of his arahants were unable to have this particular skill in teaching. So what we do have is a whole bunch of tools, and we throw those tools out. And it's up to you to pick up and use the tool that's appropriate to you in the present moment. I spent some time, my start of my ordained life was with Ajahn Sumedho's temple. And that's very much their style there. They'll just throw out Dhamma. He would just throw Dhamma out endlessly, this bit and this bit and this teaching and that teaching. And he never gave any instructions. He used to hate it when people would like, yes, but what do I do? And he used to get this tortured look on his face. It was like, I've given you all this stuff. You have to go and it's like being given the ingredients, but you make up your own recipe. So we're given these tools. We're working a little bit in the dark. We have to get dynamic. The task ahead of us is impossible. There's no way you can do it. You're never going to get enlightened, because the you is not what gets enlightened. The ego is not what gets enlightened. You have to get out of the way, and then enlightenment can happen. How do you do that? Give up all your desires, all of it, every desire you have. Have you tried that? You tried it for 10 minutes, half an hour. I won't have any desires at all. It's impossible. Desire to move. You desire to get up and go for a pee. And it's not like you can stop it. It's like the desire comes up. I've already failed. You know, whether you follow the desire or not, you know, the desires are still coming up. So the job ahead of us is impossible. It's an impossible task. And all good fairy tales start with an impossible task. And all of the heroes or the heroines in the fairy tale to complete the impossible task are given a tool or a weapon. So Jack and the Beanstalk, his tool was he took the family cow and sold it and he got 5 lousy beans. What's he going to do with 5 beans? But these 5 beans are what enabled him to solve all the problem. His family's poverty and his sick mother was his problem. Luke Skywalker, especially for you. Luke Skywalker is given a lightsaber. It's no accident. You know, George Lucas didn't put the lightsabers into Star Wars just for fun, just for special effects. In actual fact, it was the opposite. It was very hard because they were using fluorescent tubes. And every time they swung at each other, they would smash. So all these shots where they were doing these fights had to be done in like 500 takes, the smashing of all of these tubes. One of the reasons why he did the last 3 films, which of course are the first 3 of the episodes of the story, 10 years ago or something now, was the special effects had changed to such a degree that he was now able to make Yoda have lightsaber fights, etc. So what is Luke Skywalker facing? The evil empire. It's in control of the entire universe. They've got a gun that can blow up a planet. And Luke Skywalker has a lousy little lightsaber. How's he going to win? Rapunzel, all she had was long hair. Snow White, all she had was charm. We have to have a tool to complete the impossible task. And all good fairy tales are stories of the impossible task that gets completed. And our main tool that we're given in Buddhism is this quality of sati, or sati sampajanya, which we translate as mindfulness. As I mentioned in the first talk, we could also call this recollection. Instead of saying, I'm here, you might say, I'm recollected. You're recollecting yourself. You're recollecting your mind back to yourself. Or awareness, or bare attention. There's all kinds of translations we use for this word mindfulness. It doesn't seem like very much, mindfulness versus non-mindfulness. I remember as a kid, I was driving home from work with my father in the van. And I kept seeing that half the time in the van, I would just be like lost in dreaming about stuff. And then when my attention came back into the van, I didn't know what to look at. So I was wondering, should you let your eyes glaze over and you go off into a fantasy? And so I asked my father and he said, I don't know, but you should be thinking something. He had no idea, like, what was mindful and non-mindful, what was being lost in dreaming or thinking or doing something, and what was being aware again. If it's never been pointed out to you as a child, then you're not really going to be aware of the difference, awareness and non-awareness. It doesn't seem like very much, just as awareness. I mean, how's that going to get you enlightened? But this is the tool, this is the little tiny weapon that's going to enable you to complete the impossible task. So we practice mindfulness, start to develop this quality. You note what is the difference between being mindful and not being mindful. To begin with, you get mixed up between the content and the awareness. You know, I become mindful of my feet, become mindful of my hand. After a while, you become aware of awareness, conscious of consciousness, while you're eating, while you're walking, while you're doing different things. One of my favorite kinds of walking meditation is walking through Bangkok. And it's really beautiful because your mind can stop. You see your body dodging in and out of people all by itself. You don't even have to control it. It's like, wow, it just does it. It's like a CG puppet or something that's just operating by its own rules. Of course, it's a little easier for me in Bangkok because people kind of part. And I really noticed that when I came to Hawaii last time, that walking around the street and I kept bumping into people. But you're not getting out of my way. You're so rude. What's wrong with you? Monks who disrobe actually find this, have these kind of experiences. They'll get on a bus and a lady will come and sit next to them and they're like, ah. So we practice this. So we sit down and we practice and we say, okay, then I want peace. Now, I've heard about enlightenment, and this is very important. If you haven't heard that there is some kind of goal, then you're not going to seek it. And this, in fact, is the condition of most people in the world, that they don't really know about enlightenment, so they're not going to seek it. So then their lives are going to be caught up with regular daily things. Personally, I believe that we all have an innate, we might say memory or awareness. I think that enlightenment is part of our being, the way that we are. I think our experience points to it. And I think this is why all these cultures around the world have had these different religions. People who are being called to, withdraw a little bit from society and start to look inward. And these kind of hermits and saints and sages have always been respected in all cultures around the world. There's one in Romania, and he was a hermit who lived in a cave for 35 years, I think it was. And he became known to the world's press, at least, as me, because I read the article. He became known because one day he went down to the police station and filed a complaint that his cave had been robbed, and he'd lost his laptop, his printer, and his monitor. That's my kind of saint, that's my kind of guy. I like that. So I think we have this innate knowledge or understanding that there's enlightenment. I think all of our experience points to it. In the Tibetan tradition, they say that even hearing one word about enlightenment will guarantee you success, guarantee you enlightenment. So like the Lotus Sutra, even if you've only heard one line from the Lotus Sutra, then you're guaranteed to become enlightened. They also say that even if you've only seen one corner of one scripture, you're guaranteed enlightenment. They don't tell you how long. When I went to India, the Runachala, where Ramana Maharshi used to live, and they say if you walk around the mountain, you're guaranteed enlightenment. And it's quite a walk. It takes about 6 hours or so. So I walked around and got back to the office, and I went to collect my enlightenment. And they couldn't tell me when it was going to come. It's just like ordering anything, really, isn't it? So we get into the practice and we hear about enlightenment. We know that there's something there. And ever after that point, then nothing is really going to be quite satisfying, because you start to notice that everything is going to flood out of your hand. Whatever it is you can get to is going to be disappearing. However well you can set yourself up, you're going to get sick. However well you can treat your sickness, you're going to die. And when you die, you're going to start it all over again. Adolescence, all these horrible things that we went through, you're going to have to do it again. Until somewhere there's a calling, like, that's enough. And I mentioned the Tibetan thing of seeing one corner of a scripture. This is why, in Bangkok at least, one of the gurus came, one of the Rinpoches, and he gave everybody a little corner of scripture, like encased in plastic, and you're supposed to wear it on the outside of your clothes, so that when you walk around, you're enlightening all of these beings. And this is your job as a bodhisattva. A little far-fetched to think, but it's a nice concept to carry around with you. So you sit down and meditate, and what happens? The mind won't stop. You have this idea of being in meditation, trance, and the mind won't stop. And I know many people who have said to me, well, I can't meditate because I can't stop my thinking. And many people have actually said that to me, which I find very interesting. It's almost like they're hiding behind it. It's almost like saying, well, I would really love to be a monk, or I would really love to meditate, but I have this medical condition and I can't do it. And it's hiding behind this thing. Well, my mind won't stop. Your mind might. That's just, we're different. I can't paint pictures. You can. Our minds are just different. Everybody's mind won't stop. If you do sit down and your mind does stop, then probably you've been practicing for many lifetimes and you're just ready to gain enlightenment. However, you practice for long enough and what happens is then the mind does stop still. And I remember the first time in my experience when there's this constant rotoring of the wheels, and I was driving home from work, and I thought to myself, what if I pretended this drive was forever? And just as I thought that, just driving the car, watching my hands move all by themselves, steering, indicating, changing gear. I was like, wow. And then I thought, wow was a disturbance. I thought, that's a thought. That's another thought. Ah! And for the next 10 minutes, like, this would go on, and then I'd just stop. And just, like someone had pulled the lead out of the speakers. It's like, wow, the mind just stopped still. So then when I got home, I was like running off straight to meditate, like this. And of course, the mind won't stop still. Now, when the mind does stop, then you get these experiences. The thought stops, the chatter stops, and you're suddenly silent. And then you're like, and you've always thought to yourself, meditating, if only my mind would stop and I could meditate. And then the mind stops, and then you're like, a bit boring, really. I thought when my mind stopped, I'd be in this perfect meditation, and I'm just like, nothing left, really. As we talked about a few days ago, the function of thought is to throw your mind back onto a particular topic. So if you're cultivating mindfulness, you're cultivating awareness or concentration, you actually need those thoughts to keep reinvigorating the topic. Without the thoughts, everything tends to die off and you start to become quite dull. So we bring attention to that. We bring attention to the dullness. We bring attention to the mind stopping. We bring attention to the mind restarting itself. This is how Sariputta became enlightened. He attained jhana, the absorption states, and then he exited, and then he attained to it, and then he exited, and he watched the changing of the mind as he entered and exited jhana. Jhana means the mind is totally stopped. There is no more suffering in jhana. However, it's only an attainment by force of will. It's not an attainment by wisdom. And it's not enlightenment. But there is no more suffering temporarily. And then he'd watch as he comes out of jhana, and this mind would start cranking up again. And it was watching this that enabled him to become enlightened. So we can watch this process over and over again, and all these various states that you attain to, start to see none of those states is really it. The important quality is the awareness that you're bringing to all of those states. This is where insight really starts to arise, the quality of awareness that you're bringing to each and every one of these states. If the mind does stop and then your mind goes, well, now what? You become aware of that. And if the mind becomes dull, you bring awareness to that. And if the mind becomes excited again, you bring awareness to that. And so on and so forth, over and over and over again. At some point, the awareness becomes kind of fluid, becomes kind of continual. And this is when you really start to get glimpses of, not enlightenment itself, but certainly which direction enlightenment lies. When awareness becomes continual, you're no longer being pulled out of yourself. You're no longer being absorbed into the process. You start to see this cessation, this relinquishment, this stopping, this is where enlightenment lies. This is the exact words that the Buddha would use. He would say, you know, dukkha leads to faith, and faith leads to investigation. Investigation leads to dispassion. Dispassion leads to disenchantment. Disenchantment leads to being viraka, which means being without desire, being without passion. Being without passion, the mind becomes concentrated. The mind becomes concentrated, it becomes equanimous. The mind becoming equanimous, it's able to see what is true and untrue, what is real and unreal. So you can certainly see that direction, that it's when everything starts to stop, it's when the relinquishing happens. As I say, when you get out of the way, this is when you really start to see that, I don't know if I'll get enlightened in this lifetime, but I know which direction it lies. It's not going to be creating another mind state. It's when everything stops, when everything settles. So we have this process as you're doing the practice. You've given up your normal worldly view, and we're starting to look with the Dhamma eye, moment to moment. The insights come into arising and ceasing. According to the commentaries that they use a lot in Burma, they say insight into arising, insight into ceasing, insight into maintaining, then insight into arising and ceasing together. And this means that you're seeing literally everything coming up and disappearing. Everything coming up and disappearing. Right in front of the mind. And normally, in a regular life, you're working through your constructs, your ideas about reality and your ideas about the world, and this is my job, my family, etc., etc. Now you're watching something come up and something disappear. And this changes your starts to undermine your viewpoint. One example I have is the chanting in the temple. And I'm one of these people that if you make a rule that this is what you have to do, I won't do it. And if you say do what you like, I say, well, I have to do it. And I've always been like that, and I probably always will be. And one of the things in the temples is some temples say you have to come to the chanting, and some temples say come if you want. So I'm always contrary. In my temple, you go down if you want, or you don't go down if you want. It's up to you. We have morning and evening chanting. Many of the monks are teaching in university or school, or they're doing different jobs. You never really know whether it's convenient for people or not. So you just come and do it if you want. I decided I wanted to do it, but the trouble was I didn't like it very much because it's really hot. It takes quite a long time. There's no air conditioning there. And I liked the fact that I'd done it, but then I thought, you know, I don't really like going down and doing it. Not, Thai monks don't chant that nicely, certainly in my temple. We have this, our head chanter, he sounds like Howling Wolf. You know who Howling Wolf was. So then, you know, but really watching the mind, what happens when I go down is I don't spend the entire time liking it or disliking it. I go down and I don't even think whether I like it or dislike it. I'm busy thinking about something completely different. I just sit down and start doing it. Then sooner or later the thought will pop up, do I like it or not like it? And then some days I like it, sometimes I don't like it. And then 30 seconds later my view has changed. You know, I think it's hot. Why am I down here all hot and sweaty and doing this chanting? And then I think I like the chanting. Or then I pay attention to the words and I get inspired by the words. And then something, and I don't have no idea if I like it or not. My mind's just jumping from one idea to another idea to another idea. So it's undermining the very principles that I would live by. Now I can go for chanting or not go for chanting, it makes no difference. I just see this stuff in the mind. Same for coming on retreat or not being on retreat. I can actually do either, and I really don't notice very much difference. You know, before I always thought, you know, I really should get on retreats and do these retreats. And then I got on retreat and like, I'm no good on retreats. And now it's the same. I really don't notice much different. If I'm on a plane for 12 hours coming here, what's the difference between that and sitting here for 6 hours? The mind's jumping up, leaping hold, grabbing hold of this, letting go and grabbing hold of something else and letting go of that. Buddha's analogy was of a monkey swinging through the forest. Grabs hold of one branch, starts to swing it, lets go of that branch to reach for another branch. And this is just the mind going bing, 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 bing from thing to thing. When I was younger, I had this thing, it's like a tower that you built. You peg chimes onto the tower. They had four sides, and you would peg a chime onto each side, and you stack these chimes on top of each other. And if you do it according to the book, you drop a ball bearing in the top, and it plays a tune as it bounces down. This is kind of how I see the mind. It just goes bing, 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 bing. There's no bottom. It just keeps going. So viewing the mind in this process is very different to the regular worldly way of looking at the mind. You're seeing it literally as process rather than as me, rather than as myself. This process is listed in a number of different ways. It's listed as the six senses. It's listed as the process of papancha or discursive thinking. Listed from the five khandhas, or a more complicated model, dependent origination. In brief, if you have an eye, and there is light, and there are forms come into the vicinity of your eye, and you can see, and you pay appropriate attention, then eye consciousness will arise. Now, the appropriate attention is quite an important term, because right now, you're looking at me, but you're not noticing the color of the ceiling. But if you put appropriate attention onto the color of the ceiling, then consciousness arises with that. But while you're paying attention to that, you're not noticing feeling in your big toe. If you put your attention onto coughing, then that comes into your ear consciousness. Okay? Then you put your attention onto the, you know, the glass of water, that comes into your consciousness. So where you put attention is very important. Simply having an eye and there being forms is not enough. You actually have to consciously see or consciously hear. So once you're consciously seeing something, you're consciously hearing something, what happens is the mind connects with it and becomes tied to it. You get a sense of separation rather than this just being something that's coming up and disappearing. You now get a sense of being connected, and at one end there is the object and one at the other end is me. You get a sense of self around. Contacting is this word passa. And they usually translate as contact, but think of it as contacting because it's more of a verb. It's an action that you're engaging with an object. It's come into your consciousness, but now you're actually engaging with it. This is the contacting. So, for example, you see something with the eye. You see the iPad 3 with the eye and with its retina display. You're putting attention onto it, onto the iPad, and now you have eye consciousness arising. Consciousness becomes tied to that object. You have contacting. There's the iPad and there's me. Then what happens? You get desire. You get liking or disliking. Right? You like it or you dislike it. If you like it, you're going to be pulled towards it. If you dislike it, you're going to be pushed away from it. Pushing and pulling. Personally, I didn't like it so much. Yeah, it was a bit heavier than the iPad 2. Liking and disliking engages you. What does that lead to? It leads to craving. You want to get hold of it or not get hold of it. Now, most things that you can put your attention onto are neutral. You don't really like them or dislike them. 99.9% of your life is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's not liking, it's not disliking. But you only pay attention to the 0.1% of the stuff that you do like or you dislike. These things that we like and dislike really start to occupy the mind. This leads to craving. Do you want to get it? Do you not want to get it? Once you crave something, it starts to get longer term. You know, I really like that. I really want that. How am I going to get that? I'm fed up of this. I've got to get rid of that. How am I going to get rid of this? You know, the pain in my knee. Well, I'm going to do craving arises like I don't want it. I'm going to do yoga, I'm going to do stretching, I'm going to find somebody to give me a massage, and then I'll get rid of my pain in my knee, and then I'll be able to meditate, of course. So, after then the craving, which is the word tanha, it means thirsting after, what happens is, because your world then is built up out of these things that you crave, this is what's obsessing your mind. This is a very unstable world that we live in. You want this, but you can't have it. You've got that, but you don't want it. This craving is pulling you here and pulling you there. We try to make some kind of stability in the world around us. And this is what we call attachment, or upadana. Upadana is the Pali word. And first thing that we attach to is views and opinions. Because views and opinions give us a sense of solidity. That's not necessarily a view about something like, you know, I take a rather dim view of astronomers. I don't like astronomers very much, for reasons I'll go into another day. It's not views about something, but it's more the views or the constructs through which you relate to the world. So these views, you know, like I like democracy, you know, I like my country, I like this football team, I see myself as this kind of person and not that kind of person. Etc., etc. You build up a whole world of views around, and your views tend to give you a sense of solidity, a sense of being, right? My view is that I am a kind person, and I'm going to hang on to that as a kind of identity. My view is democracy is right, collectivism is wrong, or communism is wrong, or whatever it is. Views and opinions are particularly pernicious. They really get hold of you and really... you really form a sense of self-identity around these views. In psychology, we'd call them constructs, I think, the constructs through which you view the world. There are four kinds of attachment, and the first kind is the views. The second kind, attachment to pleasures. this is the principle of pleasure, pleasure seeking. Like, well, I don't know what birth and death is. I don't know what enlightenment is. But what I do know is I'm here on this earth for a short span of time, and I'll cram as many sense pleasures as I can into it. It's kind of sensible, really, right? I have a friend of mine, and he says that he can't meditate because his thoughts won't stop. And so his view is, life on this earth is short. You may as well cram into it as many pleasures as you can get. And he might be right. He's 70, so he's got less time than I have to cram the pleasures into. But, you know, he might be right. Attachment to pleasures, attachment to this principle of seeking after or chasing after as many pleasant things as you possibly can, and that's about the sum of your life. Third form of clinging is to rites and rituals or routines. And we do cling to routines to give us a sense of solidity. You know, my father would go to work 6 days a week, and on the seventh day of the week, you know, he gets up at 9 o'clock and he mows the lawn. Time after time, week after week, he gets into this routine. Personally, I could never do that. I was horrified. I've always been horrified by routines, because I'm afraid the routine isn't good enough, and there's got to be something better than this routine. People do get into routines, and it does give you a sense of solidity. Really wacky example, Mike Tyson. So he had this routine of, before he gets into a boxing match, he had to wear his lucky shorts. And these are his black shorts. And if you watch his very early fights, he used to wear white shorts. But then, I think he's around 20, 21, he got these black shorts. He had to have his black shorts. And, you know, he'd tear the place up if he didn't have his black shorts. Many sportsmen and women actually have these little rituals and things that they go through. It's more or less superstition that they go through to give them a sense of everything's going right. If I can put on my lucky shorts and I can say my lucky prayer and I can turn the doorknob 3 times before I open the door, it starts to give you a sense that you're in control. So they cling to rites and rituals, especially in India, where somebody came to the Buddha and said, "You're enlightened. How did you wash away all your sins? Was it in the Bahua River or was it in the Ganges River?" And the Buddha gave this sermon of, it's not by washing in a river that one is purified, but by controlling your behavior and controlling, first of all, the behavior of your body and then controlling the behavior of your mind. This is the way that you are purified. And at the end of it, and I'm always amazed no one else picked it up in the sutta, but the man goes, "So which is it? Is it the Bahura River or is it the Ganges River?" It's just this one line at the end of the sutra, and nobody's ever picked it up. But I really laughed when I saw that. You know, he just didn't get it. He wanted to do this ritual. You know, if I can just get in the right river and, you know, do it at the right time of the day, then all my sins will be washed away. Of course, it's not going to happen. Practices can be a little bit like this too. But I have one friend. He also says that, he says, "My mind is too jumps around too much to meditate." So he does mantra reciting. And he has these Tibetan mantras that he recites. And each mantra is supposed to be for a particular quality. So one mantra for wisdom and one mantra for something else. I might mention, talking about the lightsaber and the tool. Did you notice, I think it's Manjushri here. He has the sword of Vipassana here. This is the tool that we're using. So reciting these mantras, how is that going to get you enlightened? You need this sword, you need this weapon that's going to cut through delusion. The last form of attachment is simply to being, and this means being this or being that. When we're not being somebody, being somewhere, being some kind of identity, you feel ill at ease. You know, when you really sit and just let the mind go quiet, and then everything starts to disappear in the world, literally the Buddha would say the world would cease when you do that. When the world ceases, you've got no more sense of being. Ironically, you actually have a pure sense of just being. But you're not being this or being that, because the world has literally ceased. One of the sayings of the Buddha was this idea of, is the world illusion or is it not illusion? And he actually said, if you've seen the world cease, you cannot possibly say the world is real. But if you've seen the world arise, you cannot possibly say that it's unreal. So I actually gave a Dharma talk about this called The End of the World. And the folks in Singapore wanted to hear this Dharma, so they requested this Dharma talk because they saw it on a list. And so when I got there and I started talking about, you know, when you sit and all the sense of being dissipates, and they said, no, we want to know about this Mayan prophecy of 2012. Is the world going to end? I thought, oh man, that is so not what I was going to talk about. So the sense of being, when our sense of identity starts to dissipate, you latch onto something. When in meditation you get these insights, when, you know, everything really does stop, insight into cessation, nirodha, third noble truth, dukkha nirodha, the insight into cessation, everything stops, and the first thing you do is you pick it up again. You try to claim it for your, oh, this is it, oh, I'm doing it right. And of course, as soon as you start to do this, you've lost all insight that you are attaining to. These glimpses are enough, however, you keep doing this. So that is the process. When you see something, when you hear something, when you think something, pay attention to it. You might notice that while you're watching the rising and falling of the stomach, for example, if you check the mind has been thinking the whole time. But your attention was with the stomach. I don't know if any of you had this experience. If you just check back with the mind, you realize there's been a story going on that entire time. You realize that I can be thinking without even knowing I'm thinking. The sense of self is with the stomach rising and falling. So this quality of attention is very, very important. So paying attention to something propels you into contacting with it, this feeling of contacting with it, feeling of self and the object, into the liking and the disliking, into the craving, and then ultimately into these attachments. The good news is the opposite still happens. If we built up this world with these attachments, this is what the Buddha called the house builder. And when he became enlightened, he said, oh, house builder, I have seen you. No more will you erect your rafters. No more will you build your walls. Even though we build this very beautiful, constructed universe, can undermine it. If you undermine it right at the base, it starts to just disappear, literally the ending of the world. When you see a form with the eye, you don't get caught in the signs and features of that thing that you're looking at. You don't get this sense of contacting, you don't get this sensing of liking and disliking takes over. You don't get this sense of craving, you don't get this sense of building attachment. So we're cutting the whole process, you're cutting at the very root. This is why you don't need to give up all your desires. If you cut at the root, all desires will cease. This is the seeing the world as process, seeing this attachment, seeing this clinging. It takes over with one thing after another thing after another thing. And seeing the cessation of that, seeing the process in reverse cycle, where without the attachment, there isn't, without the contacting, there isn't any more liking and disliking. Without the liking and disliking, there's no more craving and clinging. Without the craving and clinging, this world of attachments that we've created can disappear. Of course, it will come straight back up again. But once you've seen the ending, you know that it isn't real. So, since this is the last Dharma talk, I'm going to leave you with a little metaphor to with you as Hawaiians. And this is of one of your own heroes, a chap called Nainoa, right? And he was learning to navigate, and as he's being taught to navigate, the feedback in the ship, in the boat, was on three levels. And the first level of feedback is the wind and the waves. The weather condition would affect the vibrations of the boat. The second level of navigation was each of the islands, of all the islands in the Pacific, had its own pattern of waves. And apparently each island had its own fingerprint, literally that the waves that would come off the islands were like a fingerprint. And you could even tell which side of the boat the island was on, even hundreds of miles away from the island. So underneath the stormy stuff, you would feel these fingerprints of the patterns of the waves that are hitting the boat. And these he would use to navigate by. And then finally, there is the current of the ocean. And the current of the ocean will take you in a particular direction. And really doesn't matter too much of what you do, that current is going to take you in that direction. So the wind and the waves, this is the stuff in your mind. This is seeing something with the eye, hearing something with the ear, smelling something with the nose, tasting something with the mouth, feeling something with the body. This is the wind and the waves, the weather, just the current stuff. It's just emotion on the surface. You don't need to be too worried about the superficial things. Keep coming back to this sense of awareness. Fingerprints of the islands around you, this is the Dharma. These are the navigational tools. Even Dharma itself isn't real. The Buddha said the Dharma is like a raft. Once you get to the shore, you give it up, throw it away. So the Dharma will give you these navigational tools. These qualities are worth developing. These qualities should not be developed. The mind works in this way. The body works in this way. And then lastly, there's the current. And the current will take you in the direction. If you're holding on to the Dhamma, if you're a servant of the Dhamma, even though you don't know which direction your donkey is headed, you still have this faith, you still have this trust that you're being taken into the right direction because you're becoming a servant of the Dhamma. So Nasruddin, as he was talking to the king, and the king said to him, somebody brought the king aubergines, eggplant, you call them, yeah? Somebody brought the king eggplant. And he said, oh man, these eggplants are fantastic, beautiful. I want eggplants every day. So the kitchen were preparing eggplant every lunch and every dinner. So these eggplants are so fantastic. And Nasruddin, who's the clerk of the court, said to him, yes, Your Majesty, eggplants are the most wondrous food on this earth. So the king had eggplants every day for lunch and dinner. And after 10 days, the king said, I hate eggplants. These are the worst food on, you know, this is just, they're diabolical. And Nasruddin said, yes, Your Majesty, eggplants are the worst food in the world. And the king said, hang on a minute, 10 days ago you told me eggplants were the best food in the world. And Nasruddin said, yes, but I'm the servant of a king, not the servant of a vegetable. So in amongst all these worldly things that will come and beguile us, and physical bodies, our mental bodies, our families, our money, history, even living and dying, we remain servants of the Dhamma, then we're with that ocean current that will take us in the right direction. So good.